Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
I think you've seen that trail for Baz Luhrmann's upcoming film, the biopic about Elvis. And I think you probably felt the same as me, which is that how hard is it to find an actor in a biopic who is actually convincing as the person that they're meant to be representing? Because the problem with Elvis Presley is that Elvis Presley was so blindingly, supernaturally physically attractive, wasn't he? So you've got these moments where the actor kind of appears on stage and he's got to give the impression that he is generating a kind of thermonuclear sexual magnetism so sufficient that entire halls full of screaming girls are reduced to gibbering wrecks. And I'm not sure if that's it's terrible because I haven't seen the film, but you immediately get the feeling that this is going to be a challenge. Don't you feel like
it's interesting, isn't it? Because it stars Austin Butler as Elvis Presley,
yeah,
and Tom Hanks as Colonel Tom Parker, who
looks pretty good. His Dutch accent is fantastic.
Tom Hanks, yeah, as Colonel Tom Parker. Somehow you don't have any difficulty buying that at all.
No,
but a kind of averagely good-looking young actor playing Elvis Presley, you have huge difficulties with, because it's more than just Elvis was really good looking. He was Elvis.
Elvis, just one he was Elvis. Pelvic twitch and he becomes Elvis, doesn't he?
But, you are an Elvis impersonator. It doesn't matter what level you're doing it at. You're an Elvis impersonator.
Yeah.
And actually, the best Elvis impersonator I ever saw was the late Andy Kaufman, wasn't it? Who used to make it part of his act, who could turn himself into Elvis.
He was fantastic.
By an extraordinary act of transfiguration. But the center of this movie is supposed to be the extraordinary appeal of Elvis Presley. And you just look at him and think, no, you're an actor.
You're an actor. How can you get that across?
And it's like, you can't be Bob Dylan, can you? You couldn't be Michael Jackson.
I think a lot of that's to do with your familiarity with that person, because some people have sort of worked for me. I thought the Rocket Man movie wasn't convincing as Elton John. It didn't really matter because you're carried along by the story. I thought the same about Andy Serkis, actually, as Ian Dury. You never for a minute believed that he was Dury. But it's a good, strong story. And the Freddie Mercury, too, the Bohemian Rhapsody, which was on the telly last night, Dave. And I saw a bit of it for the first time and saw the bit where you appear. You've probably never seen it, have you?
I've never seen it.
Actor playing the part of David Heavenley sits there looking like He looks like a Timmy Mallet, really.
Timmy Mallet, that's what I've been told.
Glasses, and you just sit beside this this Bob Geldof lookalike and say nothing. It's quite funny. But no, there are various examples. But I think it works when you don't know the character well. Have you ever seen Control, the Anton Corbijn film about...
Yes.
I thought the guy who plays Ian Curtis in that was fantastic. Because I never met Ian Curtis. No. I don't know anything much about Ian Curtis. And therefore, whatever he wanted to put across, I kind of believe was real.
And he also wasn't seen that much, Ian Curtis, was he wasn't. During his brief life in the spotlight. He wasn't on telly all the time.
No, he wasn't. Absolutely. You just weren't familiar with him. And the same as Sissy Spacek, I think, Coal Miner's Daughter. I mean, I really had no idea about Loretta Lynn. So I just kind of went along with it. And Forrest Whitaker as Charlie Parker. There's one or two I thought were really brilliant. I thought Walk the Line was fantastic. Did you see that with Joaquin Phoenix as Johnny Cash and Reese Witherspoon? And they, A, they look like them. B, they kind of had this, appeared to have a real attraction for each other. And they also, they sing. They sing these songs themselves, not miming. And they're fantastic, I think. But it's rare, isn't it? It's a big challenge to try and convince anybody that you are a sufficiently
Elvis Presley.
Elvis Presley.
Elvis Presley particularly.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
I
yeah.
have to say, I am interested in seeing it when it comes out because I'm really interested in Tom Parker. And so if Tom Hanks is playing Tom Parker, clearly Tom Parker is going to be a huge part of the story. And the story of Tom Parker is, let's not forget, if anything, more interesting than the story of Elvis Presley.
It's fantastic.
This man who was potentially a fugitive from international justice while managing the biggest rock phenomenon in the world, you know, never stopped being an absolute cheapskate chiseler. Absolutely every step of the way. I think a film about the Colonel has the potential to be more interesting than a film about Elvis Presley.
It is astonishing.
As a narrative, you know, more happened in Colonel Tom Parker's life, oddly enough, than happened in Elvis Presley. Anyway,
enormous numbers of legends have grown up about him. Dying canaries, a different colour or something, to put them in his carny act.
The dancing chickens, have them dancing on a hot plate, which may have explained why they danced. But he was, you know, he was a carny. And he never lost that. You know, that he used to, when Elvis was announcing these latest Las Vegas residences, you know, in the 70s. And Colonel Parker would be there at the press conference selling 8x10 glossies of Elvis Presley. Selling them.
This is the man whose merchandise included, I think, I hate Elvis buttons and I love Elvis buttons. Every base covered. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
But I think that's
coming in the summer. Go on.
No, I was going to say, I think it's interesting because we were talking the other day about how much it matters with movies supposedly based on truth, that they are true. You know, I think it's a really interesting issue, and it's happening more and more now because...
It certainly is. It's happening because of streaming TV is making it is taking what was already a big phenomenon into something much bigger, you know, that... You know, for instance, the most recent cases I saw there, I just finished watching Inventing Anna, which is Netflix's latest thing based on the true story of this young woman who hoodwinked, apparently, New York smart society into free hotel rooms and, you know, and private jets and all this kind of stuff on the basis that she was supposed to be an heiress. Which he wasn't, and they made a very good 8-part thriller about this, really, which I think is very well done. But it starts with the disclaimer: all of this is a true story, apart from the bits we made up. which they keep putting in at every stage in the story in increasingly arty fashion. Every time they do it, they just want to keep stressing this. And so the question I have to you, and this applies to, you know, to this series, Inventing Anna, and also it went through my mind after I watched the film Belfast, and it went through my mind after you and I watched the documentary film about the rescue of the boys, the football team from the tunnel
disaster,
in caves and so forth. Which is, you watch all these things, you are encouraged to watch them on the basis that they are true or they are based on a true story. And if you get involved, you reach a point quite soon where you think, now, do I stop this and look on Wikipedia to see how much of this is true? Or do I just go along with it and I wait till I get to the end? Do you know what I mean? Because
it depends on how much they advertise the fact that it's a true story. Because I mean, I can remember, you know, realizing early on that there were certain films, you know, Dog Day Afternoon and Midnight Express and even kind of Cabaret and Butch Cassidy. You enjoyed them, but you enjoyed the fact also that they were based on true stories. That gave them some heft. And it's interesting that I read a piece in The Guardian the other day saying that critics tend to be much kinder about things that, because they seem more substantial if they're based on truth. Audiences love them. And also award shows constantly rewarding things that are based on true stories, not just kind of froth and entertainment. But with a thing like Belfast, I mean, I didn't approach that thinking this is going to be wildly factually accurate. This is a story about it's the emotional relationship of a family set against the kind of backdrop of the Troubles. And I mean, actually, it's all pretty much true, isn't it? I mean, he did, you know, it starts with that depiction of the burning of Bombay Street, you know, which is the first riot, with the, you know, explosive devices being thrown through windows. And that's the pivot in the life of Kenneth Branagh's family that makes them a few months later or a year later move to the mainland. So I didn't look at that and think, well, is it true? Did you go back and start Googling Kenneth Branagh's life?
I was just intrigued, you know, because I always knew he came from Belfast, but I didn't know any detail at all. You know, I thought, how did this person who grew up in Belfast end up talking like the way he talks and all that kind of thing? I was just interested in when in his life happened. I'm not accusing any of me of dishonesty or anything like that. It's just if you're engaged with a piece of entertainment that is based on factual matter, the natural thing is to go and look at the factual matter. And it's just at what stage in the proceedings do you do it? Belfast, I'm in the cinema watching it. And, you know, it's only when I go home I look it up. Whereas 8-part Netflix series, you think, I've watched 3. I like it. Yeah. Do I spoil it for myself by going and checking whether it's true? Or do I go all the way through to the end and then look? And, you know, and... It's.
I've not seen really this, but they really do stretch it, don't they? At one point, doesn't she steal a plane? Is that right?
No, but that is apparently true.
That's true.
And so I've got. I suppose I have a slight problem with all of these things, which is this: it's very good drama, and I really would recommend anybody to watch it. It's really well done and really well acted, and it's very engaging. But if I had a choice between watching that and reading a really good factual book about what actually happened, I think I'd probably prefer the book, because I don't need for it to be made into massive drama to find it attractive and to find it interesting. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't mind all the loose ends, but, you know, screen entertainment has to package things in a certain way and you know, and to make it fit into the standard narratives of feature films. Another one, which I saw a trailer of when I went to see Belfast, is The Duke, which is coming soon, starring Helen Mirren and Jim Broadbent. And this is, again, based on a true story of a chap.
That's a fantastic story.
Stole the Duke of Wellington painting by Goya from what, the National Gallery?
Yeah, in 1965, wasn't it? He stole it in order to give the money to help people, old pensioners who couldn't pay their TV licenses. So it was a really selfless act, you know, but an amazing story. And that's an example of people going back now. There must be a whole industry of people going back into the past and looking at great true stories, because they're so commercial, that can be made into films. Don't you think? I mean, there's a similar story that happened in 1911. There's an Argentinian guy organized, the bribed somebody in the Louvre to steal the Mona Lisa. Do you remember hearing this story?
And
the reason he'd done it, it's a fantastic story, is that he was a forger and he had painted loads of forgeries. of the Mona Lisa, and he wanted to develop a market for his fake Mona Lisas being sold to people who thought they were true, real, because the real one was now off the market.
That's brilliant.
It's a fantastic story.
That's brilliant.
Why has nobody made a film about that?
It's on its way.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
Actually, one thing that struck me about Inventing Anna is it's yet another one of those films that gives you a wildly distorted picture of what is the journalist's life, where they all magazine journalists in these films always work in luxurious offices, you know, kind of have expense accounts and large apartments and so forth, none of which is ever borne out in real life. Actually, one of the most interesting things in Inventing Anna hinges on the idea that something like $60,000 is charged to a Vanity Fair credit card.
Yeah, the idea that that those things exist, you know, which are very rare, and that you could rack up $60,000 without somebody noticing is preposterous, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but it makes very good drama in the film. Anyway, I was thinking about this particularly this week because we saw the announcement of the demise of Entertainment Weekly, the American Entertainment Weekly, which hasn't been weekly for a long time. I think they turned it monthly a while ago. And we always used to look at Entertainment Weekly back in the day, didn't we? I used to think, it's full of really good stuff. You know, this is a high-frequency title that kept track of everything going on in TV, films, to a lesser extent, music, you know, particularly TV and films. And it was very slickly done and always had fabulous pictures and loads of research and its stories and so forth. And everybody in British magazines used to look at this magazine with one thought going through their mind, which is, how the bloody hell does this possibly make a profit
any money
on
at
any
all.
Level?
No.
At all. Because particularly when you know what you know about the American magazine market, this is back in the day, which is they effectively give away the subscriptions in order to get the rate base up, as they say,
absolutely,
to charge more from the advertisers.
Yeah.
And I still wanted, I mean, Entertainment Weekly must say 30, 40 years or something like that it had. And it finally closed, you know, I was closed as a paper product last week. And I still want to know, at what stage in its life did it ever make Bean One?
I find it
hard to believe that it ever did that. And if
but
it
what
did,
a great
well,
place
hats
to work.
Off to it. Oh, absolutely.
Nobody wanted to close those magazines. I worked very briefly in men's fashion titles. I know. And it just struck me that there were people who would literally come in at 11 o'clock in the morning with a terrible hangover, spend an hour and a half opening up jiffy bags full of free things, usually die-cast James Bond cars, you know. Then they go out for a very, very long lunch with some advertiser, come back 3 o'clock in the afternoon, have a snooze, and then prepare to go out to whatever fashion show they were going to in the evening. And you thought, that's a nice life. You know, they were talking about sourcing. If you were going away for the weekend, you would source a vintage car that you could drive and a hotel you could stay in, some golf clubs you could use and free access to a golf course. You think, this is an amazing life.
Never happened to you or me.
Never happened to you.
No, I think there's a strong case for saying that, you know, a lot of the American magazine market, the American luxury magazine market particularly, largely existed to furnish its employees with a really pleasant lifestyle. That was the main priority.
Absolutely.
The things that actually made the money were very often far less glamorous titles that were actually bought by real people, you know. But it's kind of inevitable as a result of films like Inventing Anna that people will run away with the idea that that magazines are like the one that she reputedly worked
for. Yeah, the Devil Wears
Prada. That's
problem.
Not the case.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the Devil Wears Prada.
That's a classic.
Is that still going on? I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, when we were talking to, I can't remember we were talking to about this the other day. Do you still get free records? Who were we asking about this? One of our guests.
Alexis Petridis, wasn't it?
Alexis Petridis, yeah. Yes. Do you still get a jiffy bag full of free CDs every day? He said, no, sadly not. You just get a stream. You're sent a link, which allows you to access a stream where you can hear something to review it. But we're also talking to, I wanted to just follow up, we're talking to Will Hodgkinson. A couple of weeks ago, this is now, Will's the Times music man. And he told a very good story about how he arranged the music for his wedding.
Fantastic, wasn't it?
His bride's
called Jane, wasn't she?
Jane.
And he wanted Lady Jane. That's right.
By the Rolling Stones from Aftermath. And tragically, he queued up the wrong track, and it ended up being, yes, you guessed it, Under My Thumb.
Very bad start to the wedding reception.
Well, that prompted friend of the pod, Owen Parker, to get in touch and say that back in his teens, he used to work in a local wedding venue in Kent, which had a license to do civic ceremonies. And he was a musician, and therefore they gave him the job. I was promoted to the hallowed position of pressing play on the CD player during the ceremony. Now, I'm saying, if you really think about this, this is terrifying responsibility, isn't it? I mean, you think about that.
Getting it wrong, even if it's not a terrible track, if it's just the one they didn't choose, they'd be mortified.
So here we go. One particular wedding, I was up on the mezzanine, he says, looking down at the assembled throng of guests. Good picture painting this.
Yeah.
I picked up the three CDs that had been laid out for me next to the CD player. And they had yellow post-it notes on each CD with the track number scrawled in biro. I teed up track whatever on Chris de Burgh's Greatest Hits. And yes, it was The Lady in Red. So even the doors flew open to reveal the bride resplendent in red. And so he plays it, you know, and that was fine. So says the next piece of music during the signing of the forms, the registrar forms, was as boring as it could be. It was Air on a G-String from a classic FM promotion. I can imagine that. Now, he says, the finale. As they approached their triumphant exit, I picked up the third CD,
which is 40 licks,
compilation of the Rolling Stones. Post-it note said, CD 1, track 8. I look at the track listing. Oh, shit. Track 8, CD 1 is Under My Thumb. So you can imagine him sweating. Can't be this. So he checks post-it note again and checks track 8 on CD 2, which is You Got Me Rocking. Well, it can't be that. It must be Under My Thumb. So he pressed play, fearing the worst. Song starts, bride shouts loudly, well, he bloody well is now, isn't he? As they saunter out. So that was a happy conclusion to that story.
There are times when you can play that thing and it works, apparently. Yeah.
You know, the idea that if you're going to provide music for a wedding or a funeral or anything like this, that you would place yourself so much in the hands of whoever operated the CD machine that you would provide them with a compilation album which has, let's say, 20 tracks. Therefore, there's 19 chances it can be wrong, if you think about it. Yes?
Why wouldn't you give them the track you want them to play?
Why wouldn't you just burn the track
exactly
on one CD so that nothing could go wrong? I would just be, you know, I'd be having kittens if I felt I'd given that kind of responsibility to somebody else, you know.
You have to do it yourself. Rocky start.
Absolutely.
I know.
So anyway, another thing further to Will Hodgkinson, I'll chat with Will, because I think the piece of music he had played for him at the wedding was Love's Forever Ever Changes, wasn't it?
I think it was.
That's how it was.
Yeah,
it,
and more again, I think. Yeah.
Entered the conversation, yeah, and more again. And I think he also chose it as his best CD of all time. And then we raised the point that we make again and again, which is I don't particularly like Forever Changes My Love. So this has now become such a kind of transgressive thing to say. People always want me to do presentations on why don't you like Forever Changes My Love? And so following the podcast, they got people go in touch and go and explain why you don't like Forever Changes. As if, you know, as if I'm against fresh air or small children.
It is, no, it's sacrilegious, isn't it? It's completely wrong, apparently. Well, go on, the platform is yours, Dave.
Because the funny thing is, after we'd done that thing, I did what I do every 2 years, which is I got out a copy of Forever Changes and listened to it to see if my view of it has changed, you know. And I listened to it, and my view of it is largely the same as it always was, which is very good. It's very good, but it just leaves me cold. And it struck me that it points out something about our relationship with music. That I tell what it's like. If I met a load of your friends, well, I know a load of your friends anyway, but if you introduced me to 50 of your friends from a standing start, I'm sure I would get on with 48 of them, you know. And then there might be one person I get on with very well. And then there'd be loads of other people who think, well, that's fine. Yeah, it seems perfectly nice people, but I don't feel any great kind of bond with them. I don't feel any kinship with them. And so your relationship with music is like that. That if you don't feel the emotional connection and the bond, nothing the music does is going to make any difference at all. And that's the way I am about Forever Changes.
So did you?
I don't want to spend any time with them. Never.
So you never. But when it came out, you didn't sit there and think, "This is extraordinary."
No, not ever. It always kind of left me a bit cold. I can admire it. I can understand why people love it. I think I can understand it, but I don't feel that bond with it, you know. And so I've been thinking about this a lot. And here's a further extension of this argument, which relates to our relationships with all our favorite bands. All bands are ludicrous. They're utterly ludicrous. And you can all identify the different ways in which they're ludicrous. They're Rolling Stones. They're just pretending. You know what I mean? Oasis. They're not really that drunk. King Crimson. They're really pretentious. You know, you can supply that. Or in the case of just about every band in the world, you can supply.
And if they're not ludicrous, they're probably not very interesting.
Yeah, okay. So let's assume they're ludicrous. But those that you have a bond with, you forgive their ludicrousness straight away as part of the deal. You know, you don't factor it in anymore because you kind of love them.
Yeah.
And my problem about love is I don't love them. And therefore that prevents me entering into whatever it is that they do. Do you see what I mean?
I do completely.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yo, you're right, because you're forgiving them. Because, as you say, it's like the Incredible String Band or somebody. Of course they're ludicrous, but they're not ludicrous to me. Because I kind of accepted everything they do as being absolutely fine. You're so right. You just invent rules that suit certain things and don't suit others. So you've excluded love.
Yeah, just because I don't have that kind of sense of fraternity with them, you know. Whereas the bands you have that sense of fraternity with, you'll forgive absolutely anything that they do, because, you know, it's like friendship. It's not a rational thing. It's a kind of warm thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
That you know, and go back to your 100 mates, the one that I really got on with, I couldn't be able to write down why I did. I just did. And so, you know, people always want to feel that, particularly about music, they always want to feel they can persuade you to like something that they like. No, they can't.
No, they can't. Not remotely, because you have a completely different emotional sensibility. And you can't change that overnight to suddenly become a wild Dexys Midnight Runners fan or whatever. It just isn't going to work.
No, not any more than, you know, if you took a friend along to them and said, you're going to really like Santa.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
Your back's got up really
quickly. The more they tell you to like them, the more opposed to the concept you are anyway.
There is a wonderful episode of Frasier where Frasier's radio program is put before a focus group, and Frasier, because he can't resist, goes along and watches through the one-way mirror, you know.
Yeah.
And so most of the listeners are going, yeah, I like him. You know, he's fine. He's great. And then there's just one guy in the focus group goes, I don't like him. Why not? I just don't like him. No, you got to be able to tell me more. No, I just don't like him. And so the whole episode is about how Frasier pretty much follows this guy home.
Yes, he does.
To get
he's
him
agonized
to tell
by
him. He's just agonized because he can't face the fact that this guy just doesn't like him. And so, and underneath all of entertainment, underneath everything, underneath all our post-rationalized views about why we like things, that's going on, which is, I like them or I don't like them, you know. And it's not susceptible to reason at all, that process, you know. So that's me with love. And no doubt you with somebody else, and no doubt people listening with loads and loads of, you know, of their own personal examples. And all I'm saying is, be comfortable with it. Don't worry about it. Doesn't make any difference whether I like love or not. It hasn't in any way impaired the legend at all. And I wouldn't wish to spoil anybody's enjoyment of Forever Changes or anything. It's just, in my defense, I do at least go and listen to these things every 2 years to see if I've changed my mind. And I don't think a lot of people do that. You know?
I listened to it yesterday. I always liked that record, but it struck me that I still only connect really with my old teenage self. That I never kept that record with me all my life. And I think a lot of the reason for that was it's very kind of nebulous and very woolly. It's got a lovely sound, that record, doesn't it? It's a kind of symphonic, psychedelic sound, which is really original and amazing. But it's about the most nebulous things. Lyrics about kind of, I'm wrapped in my armor, but my things are material and I'm lost in confusions. Does that immediately have any kind of impact these days? I don't know if it does. It was just...
It's not as good as it was a teenage wedding. The old folks wish them well, is it really? It's just... Doesn't roll off my tongue anyway.
No, absolutely.
The Word Podcast. Fix yourself a drink and it's like being in the pub.
Right, well, here we are. Welcome to another birthday party, actually, because it's more than one birthday celebrant this week. We've got David Carroll. How are you doing? David's in West London. You're right?
I'm very well, David. Thank you.
And Adrian. Where are you, Adrian?
Just outside Croydon.
Hey, right, okay. So
are either of you actually celebrating a birthday today?
No, mine was on Thursday.
Right.
Very good. Anything exciting happen?
Not at my age, no. I decided long ago that actually birthdays don't really count unless they fall on the weekend.
That's fair enough.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, what about you, Adrian? Did you have a full programme of activities?
We did. We did. I mean, my birthday's actually coming up this week, but the shebang that we organised was a trip to Leeds because we quite like going to Opera North, things like that.
So, very nice.
Oh, right. I was so, you went to Leeds to the opera.
To the opera. Absolutely. What did you see at the opera?
We booked two. One was Carmen and one was Alcina, sort of the Handel opera. So very, very different, but just amazing. It's an amazing company. So
God, you know, this is quite a highbrow conversation for word in your ear, Dave, isn't
it? We've heard tonight.
Well, and we also packed in a visit to see the Barbara Hepworth exhibition at the Hepworth
my gallery.
Auntie Barbara.
I mean, I came back to the email from Alex and I hadn't realised I kind of got maximum Hepworth, you know, sort of in one week.
Well, I'll tell you a funny thing. My sister was also called Barbara Hepworth and also went to the same school as the sculptor Barbara Hepworth, which is it's pretty extraordinary. So look, what we traditionally do on these occasions, traditional, I say, we've only been doing it a few weeks, is ask people if they'd like to nominate anything for the agenda or anything where, you know, I've got a question or any observation you care to make. David, let's go with you first. What have you got?
Well, one of the things I love about the podcast is it so often brings up music that I might never have listened to, and I get dragged into all sorts of rabbit holes to go and investigate stuff. And I had a couple of thoughts. Is there sort of an album or two that you guys think has ever been sort of particularly undervalued or never quite achieved what it should have? I'm always intrigued to hear good albums that never quite got the airplay that they otherwise might have. And equally kind of related to that, are there any sort of artists that you've rediscovered or reconnected with in the last sort of, you know, year or two during all this lockdown stuff?
Well, who wants to go first, Mark? That's do you want to go first?
I've reconnected a bit with John Faye. Dave and I have talked about him. It's wonderful, wonderful slide guitar player, old blues guitar player. I've listened to a bit of him. What have you just do, Dave?
I've listened to, as I keep droning on about, I've listened to tons of jazz in the last year or so. I listened to a lot of instrumental music, but I listened to all kinds of things, really. And I've gone through phases of kind of rediscovering or reconnecting with things like the Incredible String Band, you know, which... Because, you know, I suppose, and this relates to your first point, you know, is there anything that didn't get a fair shake? Well, yes, I'm sure there was. But I suppose the view I've come to is everything gets a fair shake eventually. It may take absolutely years. John Fay being a classic case. Yes. You know, these records made in the late 60s, early 70s. Guy who died, I don't know, 20 years or 10 years ago, certainly. And, you know, all that stuff just remains in the present nowadays, doesn't it? Thanks to streaming services and YouTube and the ease of pursuing any interest in anybody. And so everything eventually gets kind of a fair shake. But also, oddly enough, you get things that are so popular, they seem to be overexposed to the point of nausea. And then they go through a long period where nobody plays them at all. And then you can suddenly rediscover them and find new delights in them. And my live example of that is Phil Collins. Phil Collins, you know, was so overexposed at the point of, you know, face value and all those records. You just couldn't escape them. And now if you go and listen to them, they still sound remarkably fresh. And you find delights on those records that you probably didn't notice at the time because they were kind of there was too much emphasis on the hit single and so forth, you know. So there's, you know, my point is there are records you can discover that you already own.
Yeah, I think that's true of the 1980s. I think there's a lot of stuff from the 80s and early 90s, which there was such a volume of music out there that you kind of probably didn't listen to it enough. But you go back, as you say, with Phil Collins and listen to some of that stuff now and you think, wow, actually, this is pretty good.
Oh, absolutely.
What and have also you rediscovered?
Go on.
So go for on. Me, I mean, there's from the 80s, there was a whole cadre of sort of Scottish rock and indie bands. And there's one in particular called Love and Money that were around. I think they had four or five albums out, but they've got, there's one album that I must have played it about 20 times in the last 6 months called Strange Kind of Love. And when I went and sort of thought, I must find out a bit more about this, you then suddenly discover that it had a guest appearance from the drummer from Toto on it. And I think, what's his name? Donald Fagen was also party to the production and had an unwritten credit on it. And you just think, this is an amazingly polished album for something that came out in the 80s. Yeah. Brilliantly crafted songs.
Do you know that, Dave?
I've heard of them. Yeah, I've heard them many years ago. But what surprised me there is, did they make four albums? They probably did, actually. I'm not arguing with you at all. But it's amazing that this group's made four albums and not a ripple on the pond.
No, no, that's right.
Much was the economy at the time that you could. Now you make one album and they'd be booted out, wouldn't you?
Yeah, they charted, I think, in the lower end of the charts. But, you know, I think they had some success touring as a support act with people like Tina Turner and various others over the time. But, yeah, you kind of listen to some of their albums and think, my goodness, this was really polished stuff. When a lot of the stuff in the 80s was quite thin music or thin musically.
Possibly, yeah. Well, but here's the point. Everything nowadays lives forever. It's all twirling around in space forevermore. You know,
you're never going to miss it.
Somebody eventually picks up the, you know, the distant signal from a distant star, and eventually, 40 years after everybody's dead, somebody out there hears something, and it ends up getting sampled, you know, turned into some kind of hip hop hit or whatever.
That's happened to Phil Collins, actually, wasn't it? I mean, you know,
absolutely. I tell you, a strange thing I was reading this morning. Was that the great voguish drum sound of the 80s and the 90s and so forth was the John Bonham drum sound. Its popularity coincided with the death of John Bonham. You know, he died, then the drum sound became really famous and still is really famous.
It is.
And it's probably more famous now than ever before. No, it's an extraordinary thing. So, you know, that's my point. You know, this stuff lives forevermore and the record, the next record you can fall in love with is something you already own. And you probably haven't listened to it even listen to it at all. So, interesting point.
Yeah.
Adrian, what about you? Have you got anything you'd like to run up the flagpole?
Well, I was just going to come back to something that, you know, on David's point, which was that, David C, I think kind of two things probably happened a bit to me and perhaps lots of other people mentally during lockdown, which is, you know, you had that little bit more time to explore. So you go a bit deeper into whatever it was you were listening to or had discovered. But also, and maybe this is a bit more unusual, that there's something about not really being able to do very much or go out of the house, which made me reconnect mentally very much with being a teenager in my bedroom and having quite sort of restrictions, you know, on my time, on my activities. And so I found myself going back to a lot of the music that I was listening to when I was growing up, popular or otherwise. I mean, you know, Ultravox or something would be an obvious example, one of my favourite bands when I was growing up.
So usually those things fall into two categories. One is the records you listen to that you heard when you were a teenager that you can only access through your teenage mind. And the others is stuff that you've kind of grown older with and still has some relevance today. Do you find that?
I do. I find it difficult to kind of, and I mean, since I got into classical music, it's been a lot like this, is that I do find it difficult to compartmentalize because I keep hearing bits in certain genres that remind me of bits in other genres and stuff like that. So it actually gets harder and harder to keep an organized brain about it all, you know, than easier. But yeah, so one of the things I find overwhelmingly about some of the music I go back to is that it's stranger than I remember. You know, in the 80s, you know, I think, you know, like when I was in my early teens, to me, it was all just, you know, it came to me as pop music. And, you know, it's only when then when you listen to sort of album tracks, even by bands like, you know, Duran Duran, who just felt to me like a sort of, you know, cheerful pop band at the time, and you go back and play some of their records and, you know, you hear something like The Chauffeur, I think, very differently when you're, you know, my age than than when I was about, like, you know, 13 or 14. I mean, that's just an example that popped into my head, but, you know, I've been going back to a lot of that 80s music.
I had that, funny enough, recently with Japan, which was a band at the time. I never really sort of got. But actually, you listen to some of their tracks and they're just extraordinary. I mean, Gentlemen Take Polaroids, and you think, wow, what a fantastic song.
I suppose it just relates to the fact that you only have so much brain space, don't you? You only have so much mental bandwidth to take in all this stuff. And, you know, if there were no new records for the next 5 years, I'm sure musicians wouldn't like it and studios wouldn't like it, record companies wouldn't like it. I don't think it wouldn't affect me very much at all.
You could catch up.
There's tons and tons of stuff to catch up. If all you did was identify 1 year in the past and went and looked into the records of that year, you'd find a staggering amount of stuff that either you've never heard or you've never heard while in the appropriate state of mind to be receptive towards it. And I know this is the thing I keep on droning on about, that the state of mind is the important thing. It's not the music. There's tons of music. There'll always be tons of music. It's you only have a certain amount of brain, go back to my brain space point, you know, to devote to listening to music in a kind of committed way.
And it's that time, as Adrian sort of alluded to sit down and actually listen to an album from start to finish. You know, and spend that 40, 45 minutes listening to every track on the album. And you actually realize that some albums were brilliantly put together just in terms of the sequence of songs, and that there was clearly a thread running through them that you think, actually, they knew what they were doing. It wasn't just a random, we've got 10 tracks, let's just bung them on.
Can you think of an example of that?
Well, I just think some of the, you know, so the one that sticks out for me is something like Aladdin Sane by Bowie. You just think the way that sort of every single track, the sequence just feels absolutely right. And it's having the time to listen to it. And now actually it's one of those albums I find very hard to just dip in and out of. You almost have to put it on to listen to it because it is the whole experience.
And presumably what everybody's done in the last 2 years is we've spent far less time listening to music on the move than we would have done in the 2 years before that. Because that's when most people listen, isn't it? They're commuting or they're,
so you're not nearly as distracted.
Yeah, that's
right. It's a totally different, you know, because when you listen to music on the move, you're listening to music to keep out the world on you kind of thing, rather than particularly listening to the music. You know, you're using it as a bit of a soundtrack to your moving about in space.
Yeah. Also, I find one of the joys of vinyl is it's actually much harder to skip tracks because physically have to get up. Whereas actually when you're streaming something or it's on a,
phone,
you just fast forward or skip or randomize it somehow. Which you can't do with vinyl.
No, absolutely. Not unless you want to risk an appalling scratch, you know, if you're
if you're
not handling too well things too well. Well, look, thank you very much, gentlemen, for food for thought for us and for the rest of the massive. All the very best of your birthday week. David, you've already had yours. Adrian, you've got yours to come. And so, you know, happy birthday to both of you, and we'll see you on the road.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
We're joined by Alex. Who are the greatest tambourine players in popular music?
Liam Gallagher.
Stevie Nicks always famously had her tambourine taped up so it didn't make any noise. Is that right?
There was Mick. Mick used to play the tambourine. I'm trying to think which records Mick used to play the tambourine on, early ones.
The other great... there's a prominent tambourine on Satisfaction.
Okay, well, maybe he did Mick? That on... you probably would be.
Maddie Yeah, come on.
Phil May from The Pretty Things?
Yes.
And didn't... Roger Daltrey. Am I not... Roger Daltrey. Okay, you're probably right. Yeah. And does it ring a distant bell with me, Mark, that Roger Chapman, out of Family, used to play the tambourine?
Yeah, I think he did.
Didn't he used to fling it out into the audience as his party trick? And people would fling it back. Limited amount of equipment at those
days. That's great.
So there we are. Who are the great tambourine players in rock? Please feel free to get in touch and tell us your additions to that very select list. What's the email, Alex, if anybody wants to do that?
Oh, yeah, the email is wiye.london@gmail.com.
Okay, simple.
We should plug various things we've got coming up. One of which is the John Ronson Word in Your Attic we did the other day, which is fantastic. The columnist and writer John Ronson, which is really good, I thought.
And filmmaker and podcaster.
And filmmaker. Oh, he's so good. There's a wonderful bit in it where he talks about joining Frank Sidebottom's band. And he says, it's such a great line. He says, there is literally nothing more exciting for a 19-year-old than being in a van heading up the M1 next to a man wearing a papier-mâché head. You just think it's really, really funny. And he has a great theory about music being like blue cheese, he says, which I really subscribe to. He says, it's a bit like blue cheese. You only acquire a taste for certain things at a certain age. Your palate changes and they suddenly become accessible. And I felt that about things like Captain Beefheart, you know what I mean? You just made no sense at all. It's a bit like, it's like Stilton. It's like oysters, isn't it? You know, it's like.
Tell me a side question about Captain Beefheart. Do you ever play Captain Beefheart when your good lady wife is in the house?
Never in a million years, not even in the house, no. Because I would feel it was just wrong. I would wait for the door.
Not even in Chiswick.
Are you playing Captain Beefheart? Well, stop it. Someone somewhere in this house is playing Captain Beefheart. No, they're not. No, nothing. Nothing to see.
Honestly, reminds me, honestly, do you remember Izzy Izzard used to do that wonderful routine quite early on?
It was about that cat. About
when you hear it, when you hear a cat purring behind the sofa. It's not purring, it's drilling.
Yes, that's right.
So you'd look over the back of the sofa and there'd be a cat going, just look at you going, are you...
it's just me.
As soon as you looked away, it put headphones on and picked up its drill.
It's so brilliant.
It's one of those jokes. I've never revisited that joke. And there must be 20 years since I heard it, Alex. I've never gone back to the routine to check that my memory of it is right. Because I wouldn't want it to be proved wrong. You know what I mean?
Sure, that's right. So perfect.
What I remember has maybe making me laugh for 20 years. You know, every time I think about it, a cat behind the sofa drilling. I don't want to spoil it at all. So that's John Ronson. We've also, who else have we talked to?
We've got Alexis Petridis. Mike McCartney is up, I think.
McCartney.
With his bottle of efficacious
medicinal compound.
Yes. And we've got to come. We have Jane Savage, I think, and Alexis Petridis. All good,
absolutely.
They'll be coming out soon. So lots of
so stuff. It's all the more reason why you should you know get behind the wheel and help us in our Herculean efforts by becoming a Patreon supporter if you're not one already. And you know how to do that. You go to patreon.com, word in your ear, and you'll be getting all this in full glowing color. And you'll be getting it before anybody else does. Who has joined their throng in the last week or so, Alex? Anything you'd like to add?
Patreons,
come on board.
Whatever the collective noun. Trying
to find my bosun's whistle. Go on.
Whatever the collective noun for a group of patrons is, we have it. Starting with
a benefit.
Of patrons. Alistair Farr.
Hello, Alistair. Nice to have you on board.
Give him a little toot on the harmonica.
Cracking tootage.
Very good. Yeah.
John Francis.
John, nice to see you, John. Go on.
Phil Turner and Paul Monaghan, who are both birthday patrons.
Oh, Phil and Paul, who will no doubt be catching up with on the occasion of their birthday. Go on.
Neil Morris.
Hello, Neil.
Rachel Bealey.
Hello, Rachel.
Hello, Rachel.
And Paddy Kelly.
Fantastic. Paddy Very Kelly. Nice, well,
nice to have you all on board. Actually, you're playing the harmonica reminded me of this. There's a new album out. Taj Mahal and Ry Cooder have got together and
fantastic.
Re-recorded the I wouldn't say the greatest hits of Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee.
They but, have. You know, I saw that.
And there's a wonderful clip on YouTube, which is obviously just shot in
Alex's ship. On Alex's ship.
Is it a back, is it abandoned ship, Alex?
Women and children first. Abandoned
it's
ship. Fine.
It's nothing to worry about. Everybody's safe.
Women and children first, really crew, funny. And then finally musicians. And then finally
Beatles
impersonators.
Yeah, yeah. Women and children.
You're going to have to swim for it.
Women and children, musicians, bass players, then...
So, yeah, they Ray Cooder and Taj Mahal recorded in Rai's living room with his son, Joaquin Cooder, playing percussion, which I always love, actually, because it is percussion. It really adds something to it. And I think Ray Cooder's living room recordings are a hugely underrated source of fantastic stuff. You can find it all
They're
over the
beautiful.
Internet.
Beautiful. There's loads of those. They're beautiful. And such a nice sound.
Really... A lovely sound. Yeah, yeah, absolutely yeah. lovely sound. So, yeah, that's highly recommended. What else we got to talk about, Alex? Anything we've got to catch up with? Any other business? Or is that the end?
Well, we have the Rabbit Hole first episode.
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah. Patreon, it's out, isn't it?
Down the rabbit hole. Yeah, we, Mark Allen and I, pursue our strange enthusiasms. And that's only available to Patreon supporters.
Only so
if you're, not one of their number, here's another reason why you really should be.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, Prime members. You can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.